Welcome. You know, I'm just looking over my notes, and I really have no idea where to begin because there's so much rich material, and I feel like we're out of time. But we'll just do a little tour de force. So we're basically what we've been looking at so far is we've been exploring these different models of awakening, right? And we're looking at a couple of things. We're looking at how different traditions conceived of. Really, the question is, what are we doing here? I mean, really, when we come down to it, the question has to become, what is our purpose here on life, in life? And you see some common threads that run through all of these different traditions. And I wanted to start with reading a quote from the Cloud of Unknowing. So he says, again, it's an anonymous author. We don't know who it was. We know it was a Carthusian monk. We think it was, but we don't know much more than that. It was written in Old English. Middle English or Old English? Any English scholars? I was reprimanded because there's a very severe difference. What's that? 14th century, I think? Middle. All right. I'll Google it later. So he says this. He said, "A man is humble when he stands in the truth with the knowledge and appreciation for himself as he really is. And actually, anyone who saw and experienced himself as he really and truly is would have no difficulty being humble, for two things would become very clear to him." Okay, so what he's saying there is, if you saw reality directly, I'm putting in the slight Buddhist lingo, right? If you experience reality directly, if you had a direct perception of reality, you would experience two things. Now, if you remember, this is where we left off with the Buddha, right? The Buddha achieved this state of enlightenment, and he saw four basic things. What were they? What was the first thing he realized? Yeah, all life is suffering. What's the second thing? Yeah, that there is a cause for suffering, which is a nice second thing to follow it up with, you know? Because if you just said all life is suffering and, you know, that's all we can say about it, there's not much hope for us. But if you can say then there is a cause to suffering, right? What's the third thing? There is an end. And it's so simple that we miss it. Because we have to ask ourselves, who here really believes that there is an end to suffering? And when you look, I feel that when you look deeply in Scripture, they're not saying, whether it's Christian or Hindu or Muslim or Buddhist, they're not saying there isn't an end in the afterlife. Over and over, it's there is an end here in this present life. It's possible for you to get to a place where you no longer suffer. And then what's the fourth thing the Buddha realized? Yeah, that there is a path to the end of suffering. There is a step-by-step way of getting there. And these models of awakening are simply those step-by-step ways. So, interestingly enough, the author of The Cloud just basically saying, if you could actually experience yourself as you truly are, I mean, what does that mean? I don't even know, right? Because I only experience myself through these, almost through these filters of like obscure filters. These diluted filters are the only way I can experience myself. But he's saying, what if in your spiritual practice you had a glimpse of experiencing yourself as you truly are? A direct perception of the reality. He says you would realize two things. It's interesting. I mean, sometimes I notice my mind just reads through scriptures and I miss some of these gems, right? Because you miss the implications in these. Sit with it. In the Benedictine monastery, we read everything three times, and we read it slowly. And it's a very beautiful practice, because when you read something, the first time your mind just is kind of getting a general sense of it. The second time you can slow down and start to hear things. And then the third time, the implications become apparent. It's a beautiful practice. Try it. As opposed to just reading and reading, just take a line and just read it three times and then sit with it. So, what are the two things? He says this.
In the first place, he would see clearly the degradation, misery, and weakness of the human condition. It sounds a little bit what the Buddha saw, right? He would see clearly the reality that we're miserable. And we've talked about this. Particularly the image that always comes up for me is seeing a mother talk to her meth addicted son, right? And she's saying, just come home, like I'll take care of you, like you can get out of this. And he said, Mom, would you leave me alone? I'm happy, right? Because in his, and he's pockmarked, you know, he's homeless, he smells bad, and in his mind, he was content, right? But his mother is seeing something different. She's like, no, you're not happy. It's a funny thing to try to convince somebody they're not happy, right? I mean, usually we're trying to do the other thing, like everything will be okay, you know. But in a sense, and that's the same thing that the enlightened beings see when they see us. And we're like, no, leave me alone. Everything's good. I'm happy. Until what a great teacher Lama Mu calls pop-ups in horror land, right? You know how you go in the little carousel rides and like something pops up to scare you? And, you know, he says our lives are just kind of that until those pop-ups. Until cancer or loss of somebody close to us or the loss of a job. I stayed with a man in Brazil who made, who is the leading producer of silicone for silicone breasts. And he was a huge, huge millionaire. In fact, he built a whole separate building, five-story building for his kids so he wouldn't have to hear them party. So we stayed in the kids' building because it's just more fun. And they partied, you know. But he was telling me, and this was a man that was quite used to wealth, he was telling me, and I don't know the history of Brazil so much, but that one day the government froze all the bank accounts. And he woke up with only the money that was in his pocket. He went from incredible wealth to only the money he happened to not have in the bank that day. That's like a pop-up in horror land, you know. So most of us don't realize, and we've gone through the three different types of suffering that the Buddha showed us, but most of us don't realize the suffering. And we don't want to think about it. We cover it up until the pop-up in horror land, and then we realize. And then you notice how it goes the opposite. My whole life is meaningless. When the pop-up really hits, suddenly everything is like dark and dismal. There is no beauty, you know. So the first thing he says is that you would see clearly the degradation, misery, and weakness of the human condition. And then the second thing he says, in the second place, he would recognize the transcendent goodness of God as he is in himself and his overflowing, superabundant love for man. That there is almost this duality, right? There is this notion that all life is suffering, but underneath that, there is also something exquisitely beautiful. And it's the same thing the Buddha discovered. Right? That there is some way out. There is a path out. And St. Teresa says the same thing. And then he says, before such goodness and love, nature trembles. Sages stammer like fools, and the saints and angels are blinded with glory. So overwhelming is this revelation of God's nature that if his power did not sustain them, I dare think what might happen. So here we have something interesting. We have this idea that there is a beauty that is so exquisite that it would make us stammer, right? And in fact, it would scare us. And I heard somebody talking one time about this idea that about angels, and it got me thinking. And what's the first thing in the Bible that people say when they see an angel? Or what's the first thing the angel says?
Fear not.
Fear not. Did you ever think about why? Okay, why would you personally tell somebody not to fear not? What would they look like in front of you? They would look really scared, right? You'd be like, don't worry, it's just me, you know? Even when you come to the kitchen and the person is like starting, like, it's just me, right? So it's not that angels are beautiful. It's not that they're lovely. They're absolutely terrifying. It's a different notion of angels. Because the exquisiteness of the divine reality is more than our minds can handle. And again, you see this over and over in Scripture. Check out, what is it, the
18th chapter, I think, of the Bhagavad Gita, where Arjuna, this devotee of God, is telling God, please let me see your real nature, right? And then God, in the form of Krishna, says, okay, you asked for it, you know? And then what does Arjuna say? He says, never mind, I've seen enough, go back to how you were, you know? Because it's terrifying. There's some exquisiteness that's beyond our minds to comprehend. Which means that anything that we say it is, at this point, is not it. Okay? Do you see what I'm doing? Anything that we say is ultimate reality, at this point, is in fact not ultimate reality. It's just pointing in that direction. And this moves us a little bit into the fundamentalist dilemma. You see, I'm so attracted to fundamentalists because of their passion and their belief. You know, I lived in the South for a while, and you go into a Southern Pentecostal church, and this is not a dry place, you know? There's people that believe in the truth of religion. They're not just, you know, remember in the Cloud of Unknowing, he says the four stages, right? What's the first stage there? The common. Did I write anything next to it?
Yeah, common manner of the Christian life and a day-to-day mundane existence.
Yeah, a day-to-day mundane existence with your friends. Okay? For many Christians, for many religious people, that's what the religious life is. It's a successful social institution. And it's successful. It provides all kinds of comfort. It provides community. It provides welfare to the less needy. But it does not push, oftentimes, members into deep experiences of salvation and liberation, which is what Christ intended to do. I am so glad, personally, that I was not around Christ when he was alive, because I think it would have been intensely uncomfortable. You know, we think like God, it would have been so neat to have met him. Imagine, I mean, he's so, like, blasphemous. Imagine, he didn't say, like, come follow me when you tell your family goodbye and, you know, make sure everything's taken care of. He said, no, come with me now or don't come with me at all, right? To drop your nets and just come with me now. That's intense, right? He did not preach the secret. You see what I mean? He did not preach how to be comfortable. Really what he did was make the lives of the people around him highly uncomfortable. And you can see that. And think about the lives of the apostles. They were always struggling with, is this guy crazy? I mean, they must have been, right? Because we as humanity, up to a certain level, it's very interesting. It's called in Buddhism the path of seeing. Up to a certain level, we are fraught with doubt. We have doubt. And Christ's disciples must have had doubt. I mean, everybody around them was saying, this guy's crazy. He's just lost, you know. I mean, here he is, like, hanging out with women, letting them massage him. You know, he's telling you to leave your family and to just follow him. And he's saying that he's like the Messiah. I mean, it's madness, right? But what he's proposing is a model of liberation that's not easy. It's not a day-to-day mundane life with your friends. It's a very radical model. And, you know, maybe one that we don't want to take, but it's one that's interesting to look at and consider from that perspective. So I was thinking about us, particularly this group here, and I was thinking about, I mean, a lot of you are in retirement age or getting close to retirement age, and the question might come up, what is left for my life? Like, what's the spiritual life for me, you know? And a couple of things to say about that is, I was just studying with a very, very powerful meditation master. And I like him a lot because he's very direct. And we have great discussions. And he said, there was a room of us. And he said, okay, where are you at in your meditation level? Like, at what level are you at? And people were speaking very bluntly, which was fascinating for me to hear, see where I am compared to other people. Because meditation, you can achieve a certain level, like learning to play the piano. So it's like a piano recital for meditators, right? And
There was one elderly woman that was way past retirement age, and she had just started meditating recently. And she said, well, I'm able to do this, and I'm at this level. And it was at an astoundingly high level. You know, I mean, I've been meditating for, 25 years now, and I wasn't at this point that this woman was at. So this practice of entering the spiritual life is applicable to any age. You see what I mean? And Christ and the spiritual traditions are offering us an invitation at any time to now hold open the possibility that this is real and that this can transform your life now. You see what I mean? I love spiritual teachings as an intellectual pursuit. It's fascinating, but there's also try to go deeper if that's your tendency, and to hold the possibility in your heart that there is an invitation being held out to you, right? Modern day America, you, that you have the potential to transform your heart and achieve some kind of liberation here and now. So I was living in India. And India has an interesting practice that you have these different stages of life. You have the education. First, you have the stage of a child where you have a kind of play time. And then you begin your life of education. And then you begin your life as a family, householder. And you build a career. And then you hit retirement. And then you enter the final stage, which is you become a sadhu. And you grow dreadlocks. You guys know dreadlocks, like Rastafarians? You grow dreadlocks, and you just have a little loincloth and a begging bowl, and all you do is contemplate the reality of your existence. You go into a heavy meditation practice. Now, this is not for hippies, okay? This is a stage of life for Republicans, Democrats, that they go into after they hit retirement age. We don't have that here, right? If we saw a 75-year-old man in dreadlocks and a loincloth, we would simply admit him, right? But so one day I was walking in India and I saw a sadhu, and with the typical dreadlocks, and they cover themselves with ash and things like that. And he was reading the stock page of the Wall Street Journal. You know, I can't even read it, but it's all the little print, you know, NASDAQ and stuff like that. And so I was like, and it was in English, so I decided to strike up a conversation with him. And he said, we got talking. I said, what are you doing, What are you reading the stock market for? And he turned out he was a professor, a business professor at Berkeley for years. He had children and grandchildren, and they all were well-adjusted and lived in America. And he was Indian. He was a non-resident Indian. And then the time had come, and he decided to do the next stage of life and contemplate his navel, right? You ever heard that? Like, what are you doing? Contemplating your navel? Yes, why do I have a navel? Right? What are we doing here? It's a beautiful question. And that question can get you deeper and deeper into getting closer to God. So I said, but what's up with the Financial Times, He said, I was just, I still get curious from time to time, like how my old stocks would be doing, But I just invite you as we finish up tonight to hold the possibility that these teachings are real and they're applicable to us, right? I mean, I think of myself as lazy, hedonistic, like pleasure-seeking, cereal-loving. I mean, I can eat cereal breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I can zone out in front of the TV. Like, what does any of this have to do with me? And it's when you start to look at Scripture closely, you realize that they wrote it for those types. They wrote it specifically. The saints are specifically writing for those types of people. So hold on to that a little bit as we discuss tonight. And think about the possibility that you have immense power that you can't perceive. There's a story in Hinduism, the story of Hanuman. And Hanuman is this monkey, right? You may have seen him. And his dilemma is interesting in that he has extraordinary superpowers, but he doesn't know it. He doesn't know that he has these powers. And his friends are always trying to tell him that he has these powers, but he doesn't realize that he does. And we are, in a sense, like that. And I think it helps to travel a lot, especially to travel to very poor places, And you realize that potentially the majority of the world wants and dreams of what we already have. You see what I mean? The majority of the people on this planet dream of a life that we are already living, that we happen to be dissatisfied with, right? Like, we want something more. Like, all right, well, maybe I'll go to Walmart and see if there's anything else there that can make me happier and more satisfied. You know, that we have an amazing, I mean, just the fact that we have money, and, you know, you can look at the statistics, right? And it's incredible. But the fact that we have, we can eat whatever we want. Doesn't matter if it's in season, right? We can go to the grocery store. We can get whatever we want. We all have this power. We have money in the bank. We have credit. Right, we have just this extraordinary power that we can use, and we don't see it because it's so we've habituated it. We don't realize it, and because also we see other people around us that have it. Imagine, like, what is it? This where do the superheroes live? The Union League,
Justice League.
I mean, imagine if you never left the Justice League, you'd be kind of unimpressed with yourself. You see what I mean? It's like, yeah, I mean, I can communicate, I'm Aquaman, I can communicate to whales, but I mean, Superman, he's really got it going on, right? He can fly, and he has incredible strength, and you just, you lose the vision of your superpowers when you're just around Justice League, when you never leave the Justice League. So I'm asking you to leave the Justice League for a moment and consider that you have extraordinary powers. You have... Oh, we have stragglers. No, welcome, you guys. Imagine, I was just reading the coronation speech of the King of Bhutan. He was 27 years old. It was in 2008 when he took over power of Bhutan. And this is a beautiful coronation speech, because what I want you to do is try to feel some responsibility around your superpowers. Okay, first touch into the fact that you do have superpowers. You have incredible powers, right? To affect the world, to affect people in the world, and then try to instill not some sense of just some sense of responsibility. And in Buddhism, you cultivate this. It's an important thing to have, is a sense of responsibility for those less empowered. And put yourself, in a sense, it's a dangerous place, right? But pretend that you're a king or a queen. And in a sense, you are, right? What would you do with this power if you could really come into the realization of your empowerment? What would you do with it? And I love this speech from the King of Bhutan. Because think about it. It's exquisite for a leader of the nation, right? He says, "Throughout my reign, I will never rule you as a king. I will protect you as a parent, care for you as a brother, and serve you as a son. As the king of a Buddhist nation, my duty is not only to ensure your happiness today, but to create the fertile ground from which you may gain the fruit of the spiritual pursuits and obtain good karma." Right? Obtain the fruits of your spiritual pursuit. So I'm asking you to... accept your coronation, right? And then go forth, right? And really, and you see this oftentimes, and it's one of the foundational practices of Buddhism, is first and foremost to accept your coronation. And I don't care if you are addicted to whatever you're addicted to, you know? And I don't care if you're lazy, and you are divine in some way. You have incredible power in this world. And, you know, like what, King Henry IV? Is it King Henry IV, right? Where he's so reluctant to accept his full power, right? Shakespeare's King Henry IV, Part 1. And, you know, and finally he comes to this place of, like, I need to rise up to the occasion. You know, I need to just get off my ass a little bit and rise up to the occasion that I am here to help people. So... That said, we're going to look a little bit at St. Teresa. And she calls it, the different in different translations, she calls them mansions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What's the first one?
initial thirst, right? And this is a... She says, we don't remember ourselves as castles made of diamond. And we don't enter into the reality of ourselves as a treasure. Okay? We oftentimes don't remember that we are some kind of treasure. But we have some kind of initial thirst. Right? We sense some kind of initial thirst. Let me see if I have it marked right here. And here's how she says, remember she talks about Christ, Simon Tugwell talked about Christ as the great seducer. But St. Teresa goes along the same line, and she says, and you remember, Christ in this model is in the center, and he's, what does he play? Yeah, flute, like Lord Krishna, right? And he's seducing us with the beauty of his music. She says, he plays so sweetly on his pipe that although scarcely hearing it, they recognize his call, and no longer wander but return like lost sheep to the mansions. So strong is this pastor's power over his flock that they abandon the worldly cares which mislead them and re-enter the castle. A beautiful word there is the re-enter. We're always being invited to re-enter. And St. Teresa says over and over, she recognizes the reality that we fall off the wagon. All the time we fall off the wagon. I just got an email from a friend and a student who used to come to my classes saying he's, fallen off the wagon and he's no longer interested in spiritual ideas. But if that was true, he probably wouldn't write me. You see what I mean? There's just some reaching out. Basically, like, I don't believe in any of that anymore. Love so-and-so, right? It's just like help, right? And she says to re-enter. So we come in here, and she says basically this first level is filled with, she uses reptiles. I happen to like reptiles, but they're like scary. It's snakes and lizards, and we can throw in some tarantulas there. These are all our kind of mental afflictions. I always throw in television, cereal. My partner Anne she was raised without sugar cereal. And I think she longs for my upbringing and I long for hers. Because I was raised on like sugar bombs and milk. That's all you ate. But like those are the kind of things that exist here, right? Meaning that we hear the flute. We have some vibration in the heart. I think about it as some vibration. Like a resonating string. I have an instrument called an esraj, and it's a bowed instrument, but it has all these sympathetic strings underneath it. So when you hit an A minor, the string underneath it that's tuned to A minor will also vibrate. It's very beautiful to watch because all the other strings are still, and then you hit that string and the other string vibrates. Did you know that musical instruments do that? So when you hit a C, there's no piano in here, but if I was in a room with a grand piano and I hit a perfect C, that C string on the grand piano would vibrate. No other strings would. It's beautiful, right? And what we're talking about is entering into the fullness of who we are. So when we hear that in the middle, when we get close enough to it, we also vibrate. And that vibration pulls us closer to that center. So we enter the castle. She says, it's mostly cold and dim because the light is so diffused. There is still a love of the venomous creatures, still an infatuation with some sorrow, we would say in Buddhism. There's still a love of the venomous creatures. That's why I think maybe we can translate venomous creatures to cereal and TV. Right? Because it's not like I still love the tarantula. But that we still are infatuated with these things that are kind of really, on one level, disgusting, disgusting when you really accept your coronation. When you really accept the reality of your power, then television is disgusting. Really, because it's diminishing that. I'm not an expert on television, but every now and then when I see it, I'm just, two things happen. I'm utterly fascinated, and I can't rip myself away from it, and I'm disgusted by the belittledness of it.
even the educational shows, you know, be careful, because they put in a little feel good thing at the very end, but the entire 30 minutes before that is all just about the small qualities of human beings. You know, like a whole sitcom will just be about gossiping and belittling people, and then at the end it's like, and be nice to everybody. You know? But you know, if you're a parent, you know that your children don't do what you say, they do what you do. Right? And so television, what is television doing? What are we seeing with the, what is the doing of it? It's like politics, it's backstabbing, it's, you know, there's not, when you think about the greatness of the human mind, there's a Harvard School of Altruism, there's a beautiful book, I'm forgetting the author now, but the entire book, a thick book, and the entire book is all of these unbelievable examples of deep altruism. And you, I mean, you just read through this and it's overwhelming. Pitrok Sochuk, I think is the guy's name. But this exquisite, you know, you're elevated. When you put that book down, your soul is elevated. You want to rise up to some new quality. And I think some movies have this power, right? To elevate your soul, make you long for something deeper. So the second, and interestingly enough, at this stage, some type of discipline is necessary. And this is the stage all of us are in, at least. We wouldn't be here. We're at least in this place. So if you don't have some kind of spiritual discipline, you're in danger of leaving this. Now, if you're just right here, let's say you're on the outer edge tonight, right here on the outer edge. This may seem like a long way to go in a short life, right? But as you know with anything, you start quickly progressing when you get into the first couple. You know, to break into it is hard. To learn scales is tricky. But as soon as you play your first song, what happens? There's like, you wake up and you want to get back to the piano. You know, or whatever it is. You wake up, as soon as you taste. You know, I remember I was trying to learn the skateboard, and I couldn't get it, I kept falling down, and then I got a taste of like what it felt like to skateboard. And then it wasn't like, you know, oh, I got to go practice skateboarding, right? But I can remember, I still remember in the basement of our house where I was practicing, and I was just practicing and practicing, mostly because I wanted girls, mostly because I wanted to look cool, right? It doesn't matter what gets you into the castle, right? But slowly I got it, and then I was like, and then it was no effort needed. So if you're on that outer edge, don't lose hope, because it's like it'll force you in there quickly. And then she says this beautiful line. She says, this kind of dedicated self-knowledge, right, discipline, this kind of discipline involves a gradual letting go of unnecessary things and business affairs in conformity with one's state in life. Letting go of unnecessary things. And that's what we talk about when we talk about vows. You know, when I say vows, my friend Vicky says, letting go of things which are fun, right? But really they're letting go of unnecessary things which aren't serving you, which are just causing you to suffer on one level. So then we get into the second layer, right? The second mansion. And what's it say on your sheet? And this is the soul becomes more anxious to penetrate deeper into the castle. There's a kind of anxiousness to get closer, right? The vibration in the heart becomes stronger. And we talked about this last week. The soul seeks every opportunity of advancement. Sermons, edifying conversation, good company, and so on. They're still venomous creatures, right? They're still cereal. But you can feel more warmth. And then we move into the third layer, which, what do you have there? It's an automatic discretion. She says this. She says, limited vision, okay? Maybe what St. John of the Cross would call the dark night of the soul. Limited vision and surrender, limited surrender, but discipline has increased and prudence and discretion comes about naturally. Okay, but discipline has increased. And I think of, when I think about the third layer, I think about you slowly lose the taste for inauthenticity. Okay, you slowly lose the taste for inauthenticity. And
You come to a place in your life where you no longer want shallowness. And not only that, you can no longer stand shallowness. Right? Like you see a sitcom and it almost makes you nauseous, physically nauseous, because it's just on the shallow level. Right? It's a feeling of disgust in the body. And the opposite, when you get, I remember when I first met my teacher, I was 14, and when you meet somebody that's fully authentic, a real human being, right, you are just like, you fall in love with them, you know? You want to be around them because there's something that you so deeply desire, right? So the third layer I think of is a kind of loss of the interest in authenticity. And then the fourth, I think, is, to me, it's one of the most interesting. Spiritual consolation. And if you look at the Buddhist outline there, the five paths, you can liken this one to the path of preparation. And she says, here the supernatural element of the mystical life first enters. That is to say, it is no longer by its own efforts that the soul is acquiring what it gains. What does that mean? It's no longer, it's not, there's not as much effort, right? There's something that's now starting to pull you. Although I always bash The Secret, I love a quote that one of the men who was involved in that says. He says, what's his name? The guy with the dreadlocks. Anybody know? He's actually a beautiful human being, but he says, the pain pushes until the vision pulls. Beautiful statement, right? The pain pushes. The pain of the venomous creatures, whatever it is, addictions or suffering, pushes us into the castle until the vision starts to pull us. You see? And that happens particularly at the fourth stage. And then listen closely to what she says. I'll read it a couple of times. She says, the interior battle at this stage might also be understood as a form of anxiety produced by a tension between the desire for comfort of the known and the now acknowledged need to stretch into the unknown. Everybody relax your mind for a moment. I'm going to read it again. The interior battle at this stage might also be understood as a form of anxiety produced by a tension between the desire for comfort of the known and the now acknowledged need to stretch into the unknown. Okay? A tension between the desire for comfort of the known. In what place are you comfortable with the known? My boss knows that I don't like change. I work at a restaurant, so she changed the whole back of the restaurant last week. And she, in this mischievous kind of way, sought me out. Said, how do you like the new back of the restaurant? You know, with this kind of evil grimace. I said, you know, Donna, I don't like change. She's like, I know. I love pushing your buttons, you know? And it's that we don't like change. We simply don't, right? You know, when you come home and things have been changed, where did you put this? Like, don't move it, right? But now there's an acknowledgement that we now need to stretch into the unknown. And so attention starts happening. You see this, I studied psychology in college, and you see this in this therapeutic setting. When somebody comes in to have therapy, there are two forces at work simultaneously. They want to grow and stretch and expand, and they want to stay exactly as they are. You see what I mean? So you come in, maybe because of some kind of trauma or something, you say, I need therapy, like my life is falling apart. And your therapist starts pushing you and saying, no, I would like to stay exactly how I am. You know? And you see it over and over in the therapeutic setting. And you can watch it in yourself in almost any situation. Watch the next time you fight with a partner. There's a side of you that wants to stretch and is also fighting to manipulate them so that you can stay exactly as you are. And if you have a good partner, like Mahatma Gandhi's wife, she was extraordinary, right? Why was Gandhi so interested in nonviolence? It was because he was violent. He was violent with his wife. Not physically, but emotionally, right?
And she applied nonviolence until he became so humiliated by himself. You know, he was just so his own violence was reflected back so starkly. And that's what nonviolence is, right? That's what nonviolent action is. Interestingly enough, Tibet has not applied nonviolence to their situation. And I was just thinking about this, and it's open for debate. But, you know, Tibet was invaded by China, and the Dalai Lama is a nonviolent teacher, right? So they didn't fight back. But when you look at the tenets of nonviolence as an action, right? Mahatma Gandhiji says that nonviolence is not for the weak, right? Nonviolence is an action where you resist somebody's violence to a point where they can see their own decrepitness. And you might get killed, right? But you do it out of love for them. And that's really the treasure of Martin Luther King Jr. When you get into his writings, he was not in love with African Americans. He was in love with humanity. And he was willing to have his children's lives threatened if it meant saving white people. It's beautiful. When you get into his writings, they're very deep that way. So nonviolence is not so much just not reacting with violence, it's standing up to violence so that that person can become a witness of their own decrepitness and then be stretched further into the unknown, right? And that's what a spiritual... Think about being a white or black person in the South, and some of you may have lived in the South during the civil rights movement, right? But highly uncomfortable, right? I think highly uncomfortable to be white in the South and to feel like all of these different things, you know? And that's being what my teacher calls being in the market. That's being stretched out of your comfort zone. I recently listened to a history of, what was it, the White Rose movement in Nazi Germany. And it was a group of young people, students, that were opposing Hitler. I mean, incredibly difficult to do. They were applying nonviolence to opposing Hitler. And they would send out leaflets. You know, they eventually all got executed. But they'd send out leaflets, just, you know, pro-Germany leaflets, but saying our nation has been belittled by violence. Right? And why am I talking about violence? It's because we have violence in our hearts. Right? We may not see it so much because we don't have, you know, there's no bombing happening out here. We didn't risk our lives in coming here. But when you watch your communication with other people, we are oftentimes speaking in violent ways. We're speaking in confrontive ways. And what violence is, it's an effort to stay the same. Violence is an effort to stay the same. And people become radically violent when they feel that they're about to be pushed. Which means that if you're on a spiritual life, you should start to feel anger. You see what I mean? If you're really on a spiritual path, you should start to feel some bubbling of anger. Some bubbling of violence in your heart. Some bubbling of resentment. Because then you know you're pushed. But you have, at that moment, you have an option. At that moment, you can start to recognize the divinity, that you can actually transform things. And this starts to happen at this stage, the fourth stage. You know, I think of Clarence Darrow, right? The monkey trials, the Scopes trials. And he said... my life is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And I thought about that. I was like, I could use that for my life by turning it around and saying, my purpose is to afflict myself when I'm comfortable and comfort myself when I'm afflicted. And, I'm around yogic practitioners. I don't do this in yoga. My goal in yoga is to comfort myself in every pose. Like, and then just quickly move into what they call shavasana, which is you just lay down at the end. My sister said, if I knew that there was nap time at yoga, I would have done it a lot earlier. But when you see great yoga practitioners, there's one in this town named Darren Rhodes. This is a man who can afflict himself when he's comfortable. Because he's like masochist? No, because he realizes that there's a beauty there, right?
And so in what ways personally are you comfortable that it's no longer serving you? You see what I mean? In what ways are you comfortable that it's no longer serving you? Is it, in what ways are you controlling things so that you don't have to grow? And again, move out of this whole guilt thing, right? All that you're doing is you're limiting your capacity to get into the center of the circle. That's all you're doing. So if you have a partner that's annoying to you, right? They're like a blessing. Because every way that they annoy you is moving you out of places where you're comfortable. Okay? And they're just trying to draw you closer. Like, I am a control freak, I've discovered, with driving. You know? And my partner drives a lot slower than me. And she makes choices that I find illogical. Now, first of all, who said that you have to be logical when you drive? You don't, right? And like, I'm like, if we're going from point A to point B, why would you go over here to point C to get to there, you know? It's illogical. But who cares, right? It's my modality of logic and, like, you know, linear thinking that gets frustrated. But what she's giving me an opportunity to is move into a different modality. Let's go for a drive and have it be an illogical drive. That's totally okay, right? And let's go slower than we might want to go slow. That's totally okay, right? Like, all of these things are fine. And when I can surrender, you see, when there's a surrendering that happened, my heart has expanded. And it's happened to me a couple times in the car. I'm like, Will, you know, it's like I told you this story, but this couple at the airport, right, and they're arguing, and she turns around and she says, honey, you can be right or you can be happy, and that's your choice. Right? And it's like, I can prove that my way is more logical, or I could actually be happy. You see what I mean? She doesn't care. I mean, I might be more annoying when I'm trying to control things, but ultimately she doesn't really care at all. It's only me that has something to gain. And again, what are we talking about? I mean, it's so phenomenal that we can't see it. We're talking about that Jesus, like, is real, right? We're talking about that there is, and they say in the Katha Upanishads, just to mix up language, if you would let me for a moment, they say that Jesus is the size of your thumbnail and he lives in the area of your heart, right? They use different language. But there is an energy in the heart. And we say it's the heart chakra, this point where the heart is being closed off. Remember we talked a little bit about the channels in the east. And it's the essence of the Jesus prayer in Greek Orthodox traditions. Again, 14th century Greek Orthodox. When you go and you look in those teachings, it's all about how to unlock the blockages at the heart. And, you know, you hear, like, I heard all of this abstract language when I was a kid, like, Jesus is inside of you, you know, I love Jesus, I know, and, you know, it's like, but, you know, and I lost the reality that actually Jesus is inside of me, that there is an energy that can be unlocked in my heart, and it's called bodhicitta. It's called an infinitely compassionate heart. Infinitely compassionate. We were talking last night in class that you have compassion for puppies, right? Effortless puppy compassion, we could call it, right? Effortless puppy compassion. But how do you get from that point to that same compassion for your annoying coworkers? And what would it be like to walk around in a world with annoying coworkers? Okay, let's just say that that's our world, which is happens to be my present world. Right? I mean, whether they're coworkers or they're not, or, you know, I struggle with love for them, and I struggle, you know. I live in a spiritual community, and everybody there drives me crazy. You know, it's like you think a spiritual community, you think, like, I would have learned something, you know. Some guy at work today, he said, I told him how difficult it was to be living there, and he says, well, you probably handled it with, like, equanimity, and I'm like, no, maybe if I'd learned something, I would, but I don't, right? So what would it be like to live in that kind of world where your neighbors bug you sometimes, your partner bugs you sometimes, your coworkers bug you sometimes, your neighborhood committee drive you absolutely crazy, right? What would it be like to live in that world? Or what would it be like to walk through the whole world where every single person you saw was like a puppy You see what I mean? What would it look like where you saw, in Buddhism they say the enlightened beings come to us with like 64 different types of ugliness. That, you know, and that's how they disguise themselves. What if you saw a person with ugliness and you just adored them? You just wanted to look at them with love. Like there's a puppy across the street and I just want to look at it. Like just looking at it opens my heart. Just looking at it. You see, I mean, it's absurd when you think about it. Just looking at this thing with like livers and organs and like blood and pus and like two eyes, you know, and hair. Just looking at it opens my heart. And it makes me feel alive. As absurd as it sounds, it makes me feel closer to Jesus, right? What if you lived your life where every single person had that quality? To just look at humanity broke your heart open. You see what I mean? That's what we're talking about. Again, constantly bring back to mind when you come to church, that's what you're talking about. That's what you're talking about, the capacity. Your mind has that capacity to walk into a grocery store, to walk into a Walmart and see every being and feel incredible love for them. Not only does your mind have that capacity, but it's where you're meant to live. It's what your mind was invented for. It's what your body was designed for. And we've obscured it. That's all. We've obscured it. In Christianity they call it original sin, right? In Buddhism we call it samsara. It's the same thing. It's been obscured. And we're trying to get back to that space. And the question we always have to come back and ask ourselves is it even possible? Do we even believe it? You see, do I even believe that that's possible? What they call in the East, bodhicitta. Do I even think that that's a possibility? And if you do, then the question then comes, how can I now afflict myself when I'm comfortable? Interesting, right? How can I now afflict myself when I'm comfortable? And then when you're afflicted, then the question is, how can I comfort myself when I'm afflicted? You see, even with yourself, there's this kind of always movement, right? It's not just to like whip yourself, right? It's to take care of yourself, to nourish yourself, and then to afflict yourself when you're too nourished, you know? And you can feel it. You can feel when you've gotten too stuck in something. And I'll tell you something, and you can be creative about how you do that, right? There's many creative ways. You can talk to strangers. That's a definite way to pull yourself out of your comfort zone. You can risk rejection. Beautiful way to afflict yourself when you're comfortable. Risk rejection. There are many ways to do that, right? I tell you one way I did it, which is it didn't occur to me. I was at work, and it occurred to me that maybe I'm a little bit off kilter. And for some of the people that know me, maybe that's like a surprise that I just realized that. But, you know, because I feel so normal. And I'm like, God, I wonder why my siblings and my family think I'm weird. I'm so normal, right? But you know, sometimes I try drastic means. And one day I was feeling comfortable and stuck, right? Because comfortability, Chogyam Trungpa says it's like a cocoon we build around ourselves. And it's warm and comfortable, and then we get stuck and stagnant in it, right? So I was feeling that stagnation. So I decided to wake up at about 2:30 in the morning. And I decided, what would it be like to walk across Tucson only using washes? You know, never using a road. So I woke up at 2:30 and I had my housemate drive me all the way up into the mountains on the east side. You know, what are those? What's that mountain range called? Rincon. So I had her drop me off up in the Rincons. You know, what is it? Tankaverde or something that goes up there. And I found a wash and I just started walking. And about 3 hours after sunset, you know, however many hours later, I hit I-10. You know. But that, trust me, that took me out of a level of comfort. You know, I had like sores on my feet. And it happened to be like what, the one day a year we had constant torrential downpours. It was just pouring on me, you know. But there's so many different ways we can move ourselves out of the comfort when we're feeling too comfortable. And one way is to apply patience with your partner. Interesting, right? In that moment, and just catch yourself. It seems so small, but it's so huge. It's so much bigger, and they say in Scripture, it's so much bigger than meditating for 3 years. If you can, for a moment, when your partner is starting to make you annoyed, just pause and surrender. That small surrendering is massive in terms of the seed that plants in the heart, the capacity to then open the heart. And then the fifth level is that, what's it talk about there?
Union and faith.
Union and faith. And what time? Who's got a watch?
5 minutes.
Oh, so painful. So we'll finish up. We'll finish up, and we'll leave a lot to be talked about in the future, which might be a couple of years from now. They say, actually, in the Tibetan tradition, we have a tradition of prostrating to our teacher. And it's interesting why we prostrate. The reason you prostrate, which is, you know, you bow and you hit the floor and your head hits the floor, is because they say when you see an angel, you do that without thinking. You do that out of this, like, sense of, like, fear and awe, is you just drop to the ground. And it would make sense. You'd be like, don't be scared, you know, right? Like, fear not. But they say when you see an angel, you fall to the ground. First of all, because it's probably like, oh my God, they're real, you know? But they say it's so, the beauty of the divine is so overwhelming that it would like fry our minds, you know? So the reason we prostrate is just because as a recognition that isn't an event that happens in a person's spiritual life. It's interesting, it's beautiful. But we have a tradition in Buddhism that we don't prostrate on the last class, because, and you also don't finish the last class. It drives me crazy, because I'm like, all right, could you finish it someday? Because, I mean, I've had, like, 36 classes that haven't been finished, you know what I mean? But you don't finish the last class because it puts an imprint in your mind that we have unfinished business together. So we'll have to meet up again, right? So I'm going to not finish this class. But before I move on to the fifth level, I want to read you a poem. And it's a poem by America's number one selling poet. Anybody know who that is? No. No. The number one selling poet in America. A 7th century Muslim, right?
Wow. And
Jalaluddin Rumi, right? It's so funny. But it's a beautiful poem. It says, it's about this idea of, it has to do with this idea that we've been talking about of afflicting yourself and in comforting yourself. I'll tell you, another thing you can try when you're feeling comfortable and you want to just put a little fire, when you want to have puppy vision, right? We could call it puppy vision for simplicity's sake. When you want to have puppy vision, how can you do it? And you're stuck, right? We all get stuck. We're stuck in the world. How can you do it? One beautiful way is fasting. Go for one day without food. Amazing things happen, right? Go for a couple days without food. And it's not pleasant. It's not pleasant, right? I one time went for 10 days with just water. And it's not pleasant at all. And you realize that food provides much more than just nourishment. It provides entertainment and it provides relief of anxiety. But here's a poem about fasting. There's hidden sweetness in the stomach's emptiness. We are lutes, no more, no less. If the sound box is stuffed full of anything, no music. I mean, who's felt that after a big meal? The sound box is stuffed full, there's no music. If the brain and belly are burning clean with fasting, every moment a new song comes out of the fire. The fog clears and new energy makes you run up the steps in front of yourself. Be emptier and cry like the reed instruments cry. Emptier, write secrets with the reed pen. When you're full of food and drink, Satan sits where your spirit should, an ugly metal statue in place of the Kaaba. When you fast, good habits gather around you like friends who want to help you. Fasting is Solomon's ring. Don't give it to some illusion and lose your power. But even if you have, if you've lost all will and control, They come back when you fast like soldiers appearing up out of the ground, pennants flying above them. A table descends to your tents, Jesus' table. Expect to see it when you fast. This table spread with other food better than broth of cabbages. It's beautiful, right? And the deeper implication, it's not just about fasting with food, right? But even when you've lost all will and control, have you ever felt that when you've been confronted with a piece of chocolate cake? You know? Even when you've lost all will and control, they come back when you fast, like soldiers appearing out of the ground, pennants flying above them. One more poem about, and again, it's about the essence of the spiritual life, right? About letting a state burn through you. In a sense, irritability, losing control, all of these are opportunities to just burn through these walls and get closer, right? If we surrender, surrender, surrender. So Hafiz, the second best-selling Sufi poet in America, I think he actually is now, he says, "Don't surrender your loneliness so quickly, let it cut more deep. Let it ferment and season you as few human or even divine ingredients can. Something missing in my heart tonight has made my eyes so soft, my voice so tender, my need of God absolutely clear." And they say when you enter, I'm trying to go into this long three-year retreat, we have some huge obstacles facing us. But they say if you do 3 years of solitude, they say it's like Vietnam in your mind. You know, they say it's like hell in your mind. Because it's not like we're in 3 years of solitude with books and, you know, we're going in there unarmed with distraction, right? But they say that you hit a level of grief and loneliness that opens your heart so purely. And those of you that are interested in psychology, you may know that Carl Jung found that when psychosis was left untreated, it would cycle. And about 40 days later, the person would come out richer and more encompassing. This isn't true of all psychosis. Some psychosis is you'll really get stuck, you know. And some psychosis, you may need medication to jolt yourself out of it, for example. But he found in some psychosis, and interesting enough, he said a lot of his patients were often, they were, when you really looked at the psychosis, when you got down to the essence of it, it had to do with a broken heart, many of it. And often a broken heart as a child or something like that. But when a person was allowed to cycle through their insanity, giving a safe space, oftentimes it would cycle through and come back out. He said what a lot of modern psychology for his time would do would stop that cycle and keep a person stuck in that cycle, you see? You try to stop it right there before the person could re-individuate and come back out more full. And we can see that with our spiritual life. And St. Teresa talks about this quite beautifully. She says we enter, and then we like it gets hard, or we feel depression, or we feel stuck. So we come out back out into the cereal realm, right? And then eventually the cereal realm becomes so dissatisfying we feel the vibration again in the heart, and so we start to move deeper. So explore a little bit of this, right? You have all of this all the stuff that I'm not able to finish covering tonight, which is finishing up St. Teresa and looking at these five paths, right? These are all accessible to you. You could even just Google them and start learning about them. But the thing I want to leave you with is this idea that how do you do this? Like, what is the spiritual life? You know, what is it involved? And one of the essences of a spiritual life in any tradition is what they call in the East a sadhana. And a sadhana is a regular spiritual practice that you can come back to every day. And another reason why I love the kind of fundamentalists, particularly in the Christian South, you know, is because church for them is not a one-time-a-week thing. And the Buddhists have this, actually. And the Christians that I know are interested in Buddhism say, I love Buddhism because you guys have daily practices, you know? And, you know, when you really look at the teaching, like, for example, the Pentecostals, you know, I used to live in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and a lot of people I worked with went to church every day, you know, and church was like 3 or 4 hours, right? But there's this quality of a sadhana, of something you come back to every day. And you can design a sadhana for yourself. And there's a couple of key elements to a sadhana. One is some time of reflective prayer, right? Some time of, you could call it meditation. And it could be simple, and it could be short. It could be like 3 minutes a day of just like stopping, unplugging everything, and just practicing some form of meditation. Another aspect of sadhana is something to open the heart. And I think of this as prayer, like praying, just praying for the welfare of people who are suffering. Like if you are addicted to the news and you can't give it up, then use it at least. Don't just let it harden your heart. My teacher used to, he would cycle through all these prayers, and he'd been all over the world, so he, you know, knew specifically, but we would spend the whole morning just praying for the women of sexual abuse in the Republic of Congo, right? Democratic Republic of Congo, where 85% of women experience rape. You know, I mean, this is happening now. And so we can use that information to harden the heart, or we can use it to burn through the outer layers. And this one way to do it is to pray for them, to meditate, to think about people that are suffering in a way to open the heart. And then it has to incorporate some kind of physical practice. And you don't have to do back bends and get your feet behind your head, right? There's many practices. There's Tai Chi. I think even a beautiful physical practice is to walk around your block and just say prayers for the people in your neighborhood as you're walking around the block. That's a physical practice. That's a kind of yoga. And in fact, if you do it properly, it's one of the highest yogas there is. If you can hold your mind in that state as you walk around the block. So something like that, something that keeps you, the mind, elevated. Because if you've noticed, what the world has to offer you is not an elevated mind. What pop culture has to offer you is a diminished spirit, right? So you're just gently, compassionately fighting against that. And and think about diet a little bit. You know, we've talked about it, but what you put in your body has an effect on the capacity for your mind to care about other people. You cannot live off of, I've tried it and I've proved it to myself, you can't live off of white flour and sugar products and have puppy vision. You know what I mean? What you'll have is even puppies will become irritating. You see what I mean? The opposite will happen. It does have an effect on what you put into your body has an effect. So gently educate yourself a little bit about diet. Frozen food, we say it's prana free. What's prana? Prana is the life energy. The life energy that keeps you vital. The minute you freeze food, you've removed the life energy from it. We know that more now than we did back when I was a kid, and even more so, you know, back in the 30s and 40s. But and we have at our disposal, for example, fresh produce. We have, you know, organic meats, and we have all these kinds of things at our disposal. Relish in it, right? Relish in food. Enjoy it. Taste it. So a diet is another big aspect. And again, we're talking about how to accept the invitation. And first, do we even believe in the invitation? And I'll end with this quote from The Cloud of Unknowing. And this is see if I can find it. Yeah. And the problem with me with meditation is I doubt that it really has an effect on others. You know, and you hear this a lot. Like, imagine somebody close to you said that they were going to go into a 3-year meditation retreat. You think a couple things like that. First of all, it sounds selfish, self-indulgent, and it just sounds like weird and extreme, right? And what are you really doing for people? Like, are you really affecting humanity at all? I mean, what are you really doing? It just sounds weird, right? And this beautiful line from The Cloud of Unknowing. But let me ask you this. If there was somebody right here that was suffering really badly, like severely, like they had a huge open wound and were crying out for help, and you could provide them relief, like we would, right? Of course, effortlessly. But we don't believe so much that meditation and prayer really has an effect. I mean, we fluctuate. Sometimes we think it does, sometimes we think it doesn't. One thing you see with the saints in every single tradition is they all tell us that they have gotten to a point where they've seen directly that it has a beneficial effect. Not only on your neighbors, but on people in the hell realms, and in the animal realms. I mean, all these different realms are good energy, right? It sounds so New Agey, but has an effect on them. And here's how the author of The Cloud of Unknowing says it. What I am describing here is a contemplative work of the spirit. When you read this before, he's talking about a kind of meditation, applying yourself to meditation and prayer. He says, your fellow men are marvelously enriched by this work of yours, even if you may not fully understand how. The souls in purgatory are touched, for their suffering is eased by the effects of this work. And of course, your own spirit is purified and strengthened by this contemplative work, more than by all others put together. Yet for all this, when God's grace arouses you to enthusiasm, it becomes the lightest sort of work there is, and one most willingly done. Okay? Which gets us later into this later stage of the castle, St. Teresa's castle. It becomes the lightest, the most effortless work there is, and one so willingly done. And of course your own spirit is purified, yet for all God's grace has aroused you to enthusiasm, it becomes the lightest work, sort of work there is, and one most willingly done. Without his grace, however, it is very difficult and almost, I should say, quite beyond you. And so diligently persevere until you feel joy in it, for in the beginning it is usual to feel nothing but a kind of darkness about your mind. And I've heard this every single person, not every, but almost every person that starts meditation has this thing of, I feel like I'm becoming a worse person. And it's just you're starting to realize, you're bringing to light all of the things that have not been into light, right? And he says the same thing here. So diligently persevere because at first you feel nothing but a kind of darkness about your mind, or as it were, a cloud of unknowing. You will seem to know nothing and to feel nothing except a naked intent toward God in the depths of your being. It's the same thing St. Teresa talks about, right? A naked intent towards God in the depths of your being. This vibration that's leading you to God. Try as you might, this darkness and this cloud will remain between you and your God. You will feel frustrated, for your mind will be unable to grasp him, and your heart will not relish the delight of his love. But learn to be at home in this darkness. Sounds like Hafiz, right? Don't give up your loneliness so quickly. Let it burn deeper. Let it cut more deeply, right? Sounds it's the same thing. Return to it as often as you can, letting your spirit cry out to whom you love. For if in this life you hope to feel and see God as he is in himself, it must be within this darkness and this cloud. But if you strive to fix your love on him, forgetting all else, which is the work of contemplation, I have urged you to begin. I'm confident that God in his goodness will bring you to a deep experience of himself. Again, he says, I am confident that you will realize that the reality of God is true, right? That the reality of Jesus is true. That it's not, it doesn't end in Sunday school, but it's a truth that's being held out to us. So there's much more to say and much more to talk about, but hopefully that gave you something to mull over. And please consider thinking about a sadhana, design a sadhana, right? Design some type of practice that you do daily. I know couples that meditate together, pray together, and it could be small, 5 minutes a day, just pausing and praying, pausing before meals. All these little things that we've kind of grown up with are designed to keep us from leaving the castle. The exquisite diamond of ourselves, St. Teresa says, the exquisite majesty of ourselves that we have forgotten. We're all stuck in the Justice League and we've forgotten that we're exquisite. And not only that we're exquisite, but with that exquisiteness, we have responsibility. And in a sense, our responsibility is our serfdom, you know? That there's a serfdom out there. Like the people are relying on us, whether they know it or not, and whether we know it or not. And we have extraordinary minds. We're incredibly educated. We have all kinds of resources at our availability, at our fingertips, right? And so utilize it somehow. Accept the responsibility of who you are. And don't shy away from it, right? And and if you do get caught, right, in the scripture they say, if you do get caught in things like depression, loneliness, you can use prayer and let it cut more deeply, right? Depression becomes a point of despair when there is no vision of this. When there is no vision of the center of the circle, then it just becomes depression for the sake of depression. But if there's some vision, again, even just contemplating a couple minutes a day that you could possibly feel love for other people the same way you feel love for a puppy. Just contemplating that possibility in your heart is extraordinary. It's extraordinary. Again, just contemplating that. I'm not even saying doing it or acting on it. Just contemplating that possibility has an irreversible effect on moving you towards there. So, I probably kept you a little late. I'm sorry. And what time is it? Oh, 10 minutes late. Sorry, I'm just, I just was excited. So, thank you all so much. Please make some effort, right? And try to be good to one another. And thank you so much for Father Rick for having me and for Shell for putting the whole thing together. She was the one that said, hey, you know, we could set this all up for you. So thank you deeply to both of them. Thank you all for coming.